Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekend, a glossy audio supplement on Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... There's a distinctly Jewish flavour to today's podcast, listener, as we discuss Israel's planned overhaul of its kashrut regime, modern Orthodox versus ultra-Orthodox, female rabbis, anti-Semitism, and ice cream. Joining me to make up 30% of a minion, I'm delighted to welcome back Haaretz's Judy Maltz, who only agreed to come in today if she could kvetch about her COVID-cancelled vacation. Where were you supposed to be going, Judy?
Oh, the Inner Hebrides Islands in Scotland.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had an amazing trip planned. Every single ferry and every single bed and breakfast chosen over the course. It took us a month to plan this trip, but what can you do?
Heartbreaking.
I mean,
heartbreaking. Well, your loss is our gain.
Well, I am going on vacation, though. You know where I'm going?
Where are you going?
I'm going to spend a vacation. I'll let you know next time I'm here whether it's worthwhile. Going to Abu Ghosh, okay?
That's definitely worthwhile.
There's a little hotel there, and I think it's probably the quietest place you can find in Israel at this time of the year. But I'll report
when I'm back. It's beautiful and plenty of good hummus.
Oh, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Also joining us for the very first time, let's say hello to Haaretz reporter Samuel Sokol. Welcome, Sam.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, if there wasn't a Jewish theme to today's episode, I'd say that this is a baptism of fire, but I won't. Let's just get on with the show. So last week, the government announced major plans to overhaul the system for certifying kosher food, slaughter and eateries in Israel. Unveiling the plan, Religious Affairs Minister Matan Kahana said that the current system is sick, while the chief rabbinate warned that the planned reform would spell the abolition of kashrut in Israel. So with around 80% of Israelis saying that they keep kosher to some extent, this is a story that could affect many, many people. Judy, what is the plan here? What problems does it seek to address? And why is it such a big deal?
Okay, so let's talk about first what the situation is today. As it stands today, if you want to have kashrut certification in Israel, there's really only one way to get it. You go to the local branch of the rabbinate office in your town or city or regional council, and you make an application, and they will assign to you a kashrut supervisor or mashkiach who makes sure that you are complying with all the rules that they set. So basically, the Rabbanut has a monopoly on this.
So a restaurant has to basically employ somebody appointed by the Rabbanut as an employee of their establishment to keep an eye on kashrut?
Effectively, that's what it is. They send the mashkiach. You don't get to choose, really. And the restaurant will pay that mashkiach. This has created a system. Well, I mean, what happens when you have a monopoly? There's no leverage for the businesses. They have very little choice. Prices are very high. The monopoly takes advantage of its monopoly status to charge high prices. And also, you have no recourse. You may have seen there was, in the story I wrote this week, I refer to an incident which made big news last year when during the corona there was a very small but well-known falafel stand in the town of Givatayim that did not pay the mashkiach during the months that it was closed because it was not using these services.
Logically enough.
And no income. Well, what do you know? When Israel emerged from that first lockdown, very soon thereafter, the rabbinate sent someone, showed up at their door and say, hey, where's the money you owe us? So we don't have any money. We said, well, then we're just tearing down your kashrut certificate. And they tore it down. And not only that, they put up signs around town warning people not to go there to eat anymore because it was no longer kosher. Now, of course, the place is kosher. You know, they abide by the same rules that they always have, but they no longer have the certification of the rabbinate. And you know, it's just an example of what happens when you are a monopoly, how much power you have. So what's the new system? It's a little bit complicated, so I'm going to try to explain it very simply. basically, the rabbinate is not going to be handing out certificates of kashrut anymore. They're out of that business. They still will have a role as a regulator. Now, businesses will be able to choose one of two different tracks for receiving their kashrut certification. One track will have more involvement in the of the rabbinate. In that track, they go with a private corporation that provides them with the supervision and certification services, but the guidelines will be determined by the rabbinate. In the other track, they don't go to a corporation. Basically, any three rabbis can get together and say, these are the rules of kashrut that we've established on our own, and you can go to them. It will probably, in many cases, be more lenient. And in some cases, it will be even stricter than the rabbinate, because you will probably have the badats, which is the ultra-Orthodox certificates. They will probably prefer that because they don't like the rabbinate either. And this will be a way of circumventing the rabbinate's rules. So you can choose one of those two tracks, and the rabbinate will be there to make sure that you're following the guidelines of the track that you choose, and you'll get your certification either from the group of three rabbis or from the corporation. In a way, it's kind of like what goes on in America today, where you have, you know, different levels of kashrut in different organizations, OU, OK, all these different badatsim, but there's no centralized rabbinate that is handing out the certificates. So that's the plan. Will it happen?
Is it? Well, that's a huge question, obviously, and we'll get onto that. But in general, this is a huge industry, right? I mean, people may not realize that in a country of 8 million people currently, something like that this is a 2.8 billion shekel industry. That's around $850 million, and that's probably the more conservative figure that I saw. Right. But this is you know, more. Perhaps more about the money than about the kashrut or the bureaucracy that's involved?
Well, you know, interestingly, the rabbinate has been saying, oh my God, if we privatize and we lose all our control, God knows what's going to happen with kashrut in this country. You're not going to be able to trust any place. Actually, if you talk to some of the businesses, they say that actually kashrut standards will be higher. Because it's a well-known secret in Israel that very often these mashgiachs or kashrut supervisors, you know, because they have this monopoly status, they kind of slack off a lot, you know? They don't come as often as they should. You know, talk to people who work in hotels. They'll tell you, you know, the mashgiach is there with his entire family for the weekend, getting free room and board. Does he spend a lot of time in the kitchen? No, it's a vacation for many of them. It's a perk of the job. So that, you know, once they've lost their monopoly and these kind of shenanigans are done away with, there will be a much higher level of kashrut, according to the
according
businesses
to support, right.
that I spoke to. And the other thing that's really interesting, if it happens, and I think this is probably important news for many Haaretz subscribers, is that the upshot may be that we'll get a lot more kosher eateries in Israel than we have today. Because one of the main reasons that a lot of places don't apply for certification is, number one, it's very expensive. And number two, you know, you don't want to deal with the rabbinate. And some it's demands sometimes which don't make any sense. Now, if the rabbinate is not in the picture anymore, and hopefully competition will lower the price of this service, then a lot of businesses will say, okay, I can pay less than I would have in the old system, and then I can bring in, I don't know, another 10% more, 20% more of the pool of potential customers because kosher people will come to me. So, you know, it's a cost-benefit analysis for them. Maybe this will bring in more money because it's cheaper to do it and less of a headache.
Mm. Sam, you've been keeping an eye on diaspora reactions to this proposed reform. Some Jewish communities overseas depend on Israeli exports for access to kosher food, right? How are they responding?
The various communities, especially in Europe, are keeping a close eye on what's happening. There's both a concern among the more conservative ultra-Orthodox communities that this will affect the level of kashrut, as well as excitement among many other Jews in the diaspora that lower prices on food products produced in Israel will mean lower prices on imports to their own stores. One of the communities that is really excited about this, potentially, is the community in Hungary, not only because of imports to Hungary, but because of the possibility under the new system that they could export food to Israel. Currently, the main denomination in Hungary is the Neolog denomination, which is a denomination that exists only in Hungary and falls somewhere between conservative and modern Orthodox Judaism. And the rabbinate here in Israel won't allow food certified by the Neolog rabbis into the country. So one person I spoke to over there who deals with kashrut operations for the local community said essentially, not only will we get cheaper Israeli food here, but we'll be able to export kosher food to Israel. On the other hand, the chief rabbis of Ukraine and Poland both expressed concern that it could harm kashrut levels. I think it really depends where people fall on the religious spectrum, but certainly seems to be a consensus, even among people who are critical, that this will make access to kosher Israeli products much easier and cheaper abroad.
Explain something to somebody who may not keep 100% kosher, Sam. Is kosher not binary? Is it either kosher or not kosher? What are we talking about when we talk about levels of kashrut? One would have thought that something is either kosher or not kosher.
On the most basic level, that is correct. Something is either kosher or it's not kosher. But there's the minimum that is required for something to be kosher, and then there are various stringencies that are applied for people who want to keep a higher level, something that is more acceptable in a conservative religious context, meaning there's what's allowed after the fact and what is ideal, what people would prefer to be able to observe. And as well, very often, you see this with the Israeli rabbin now. You have the standard kashrut certification, which says this meets the minimum requirements. And often they'll use various leniencies to allow for lower prices and for more people to have access. And then you have the more stringent certifications for people who want to keep a higher level. Both have their place and both are important. And having, you know, a multi-track system like that is good. Opening up to competition, where you have many different levels, could be much better.
Does this reform then mean that the price of food in general, kosher food in Israel, specifically in restaurants, is going to come down?
I think in restaurants, it most definitely will. We'll probably feel lower costs also in hotels. Because like I was saying before, an average hotel in Israel, average to large hotel, has to employ about 3 or 4 mashgichim, put them and their families up for the weekends, and that's besides all the, you know, the direct costs of the certification service and the supervision services. So I think because the kashrut certification is such a relatively large cost in their total operating expenses, so we'll see a price drop. I'm not sure that we're going to see such a major price drop in actual food we buy in the supermarket, almost all of which in Israel does have rabbinate certification. I mean, you have to go to special little supermarkets to find non-kosher food.
Although Tiv Tam, and I am willing to give them a shout out on this podcast, Tiv Tam does offer a wide range of non-kosher products.
That's
for
true.
People who don't keep kosher.
That's true, and that's probably like the only place you can go if you're looking for it. So, you know, if you go to a regular supermarket in Israel, everything is going to be kosher. And the big food plants, the certification and the supervision is not that big an expense in their total expenses. So I'm not sure that the price of a box of cereal is going to go down because of this competition.
Mm. One way in which it could potentially come down for items that one finds in a supermarket would be because the current system requires, if you want to have a higher level of certification, paying for two different services. So if you go into an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood where the products not only have a rabbinate certification, but also from one of the badatzes, you could see a product that has two, three, four different certifications.
Right.
So I think cutting out part of that, I don't know how much it'll change the price, but we'll see to some degree or another, at least in certain sectors of the market, I think we're going to see changes.
Mm. And you also see products regionally distributed. You'll see, you know, kosher le mahadrin product in religious neighborhoods, and presumably that all adds to the cost of producing these products. So, anybody else stand to benefit from this?
Well, you know, it's going to be a big beneficiary, this organization, Sohar, which is a...
Which already provides kashrut certification.
Well, yeah, but with a catch. Sohar is an organization of modern Orthodox rabbis. They started out providing wedding services in Israel, kind of friendlier Orthodox wedding services. And they've grown, and the rabbinate does not like them at all. And they also wanted to go into the kashrut business, and there was a big lawsuit about this, and eventually they were allowed to. They do give certification, but right now, under Israeli law, they are not allowed to say that the businesses they supervise are kosher. All they can say is that they are supervised by Tzohar. Not that they're kosher, but, you know, people understand. If they're supervised by Tzohar rabbis, they're kosher. But the word kosher, the rabbinate still has a monopoly on. Under this new plan, Tzohar would be able to use the word kosher in their certification. That could have been a reason that there were businesses that didn't use them because it didn't say specifically kosher, and anyone who's looking for that word wouldn't find it. Now, this, you know, this could bring in a lot of money for them.
Mm. It's like the old line about if it's not from the Champagne region of France, then it's only sparkling wine. If it's not from the Rabanut, then you can't call it kosher.
Right.
You have to call it sparkling not treif or whatever the equivalent would be.
That's a good analogy.
This is going to be part of the budget that the Lapid-Bennett government is supposed to approve next month, right? And that budget, if it doesn't pass, means that the coalition falls. Presumably there is enough support within the coalition to get this particular reform through?
I think within the coalition there's definitely support for it. The problem is that, as I was saying before, the rabbinate doesn't lose all its control here over kashrut. They don't give out certificates anymore. But as I said, they would continue in the role of regulator. Now, they're dead set against this. So without their cooperation in this, I don't see how they're going to be able to pull it off.
Mm.
They're going to have to offer the rabbinate something in exchange for them to come on board with this. Without the rabbinate on board, it's not going to happen.
What could they offer?
I don't know. I don't know.
We've already seen, for the average person in the Orthodox community, for someone who's modern Orthodox, they're going to be supporting this. Someone who's ultra-Orthodox, even if they are against it in principle, for the most part, they don't care because they don't really care about the rabbinate that much in this regard. What we've seen recently is the chief rabbi trying to stir up sentiment against it. The other day, Chief Rabbi Yosef, in a statement that was absolutely bizarre, declared that the reform will lead to sexual immorality and a lack of modesty, because it will lead to the employment of female kashrut inspectors, and there will be hanky-panky in the kitchen. Now, there are already female kashrut inspectors to a certain degree. There's never been any report of hanky-panky in the kitchen. And this seems to be the chief rabbi basically trying to link kashrut reform to an issue that elicits a visceral reaction among the ultra-Orthodox. But I think the fact that he has to go to this length to a certain degree shows that the people who really care about fighting this are ultra-Orthodox politicians, rabbis connected to the rabbinate, people who have a direct interest in it, either economic or political. for the average ultra-Orthodox consumer, they're not paying attention to the rabbin in any way. And even if it would benefit them in the end, because they only have to pay for a badatz and not for a rabbinate certification, it's really, ironically, not an issue that most of them care about.
But I think the badatz organizations are not happy with it for, and this is why the ultra-Orthodox parties are not happy with it, for a different reason. And that has to do with the fact that the whole industry will be regulated now. They will have to be subject to, you know, oversight by the rabbinate. Their books will have to be open. They will have to be incorporated. Mm. They're going to have to play by the rules, which is something they haven't done ever before.
Mm. So it's the transparency as much as the loss of control. To what extent is this another battle in the war, or maybe the changing relationship between ultra-Orthodox and modern Orthodox streams in Israel?
Well, it's definitely a continuation of it. And we saw something similar happen in the whole realm of marriage, that many of the modern Orthodox do not want to be married today by the rabbinate. Mm. And you will see that in recent years, there are a growing number of modern Orthodox couples who get married by modern Orthodox rabbis who are not approved by the rabbinate, and they don't care. I mean, that's significant, because if they're not approved by the rabbinate, they cannot be registered as married in Israel. Just like couples who take Reform or conservative rabbis, or, you know, who go abroad. So this is, you know, this is like another phase in this growing rift. Well, modern Orthodoxy in Israel has kind of split itself, because there is the group that is much more liberal, that will be very happy, as Sam said, about this reform of kashrut, and they're the ones who are getting married outside the rabbinate. But then there is the other part of modern Orthodoxy that we call today chardal, which they were actually, it stands for Charedi Dati Lumi, which is really Charedi modern Orthodox, which is kind of a contradiction in terms. But they are the part of modern Orthodox that have shifted more to the right religiously. So the old-fashioned modern Orthodox doesn't really exist as much anymore in this country.
Mm. I mean, I would make one point that I'm not sure how much the phrase modern Orthodox in the American sense really can be applied to anything within the Israeli religious spectrum. You have Dati Lumi, the national religious, whereas in modern Orthodoxy in the States is defined by a very clear ideology of how to mix engagement with the secular world with religious tradition. It's much more, you know, the modern Orthodox in Israel, it's defined by the relationship between religion and nationalism. It's really so complex with so many gradations. I think the old definitions of ultra-Orthodox versus traditional versus secular, national religious, there's, you know, it's a spectrum. It's not, you know, clearly defined groups, and that adds a lot of complexity to the issue.
Mm. Well, the modern, I'm not so sure, because the modern Orthodox in Israel, or Dati Lumi, very similar to modern Orthodox in the United States, at least. I don't know the situation as well in the UK. But, you know, the big difference between them always and the Haredi world is that they believed in working. That's a very important part. Getting educated, going to university, working, being part of society. And that, I think, you do have the parallel with the Dati Lumi here in Israel and the modern Orthodox in America.
Mm. And this is before we even mention the Reform movement, the non-Orthodox streams of Judaism. Noah Satat, the director for the Reform Center for Religion and State, for example, tweeted that this kashrut revamp is a small step in the right direction, but she added that it's fundamentally insignificant as long as, you know, non-Orthodox organizations and Israeli Jews aren't able to get all their religious services, including kosher certificates, without going to the rabbanut. Mm-hmm. You know, taking a broader view, I can't help thinking that the whole concept of kashrut and kashrut supervision is cheapened and weaponized by people threatening to declare, for example, a current example, that Ben and Jerry's is no longer kosher because of its decision to stop selling products in the occupied West Bank. And in one place I saw it argued that that is perfectly legitimate from the perspective of Jewish law for a kashrut supervisor to take external considerations into account when deciding whether something's kosher or not. Do we know if that's true?
So that's a matter of fierce debate within the Orthodox community itself. There's no real simple answers. You have had attempts in the past to, you know, abroad to organize kashrut certification agencies that take external factors into account, such as proper treatment of workers, certain social justice issues. For the most part, on an official level, kashrut is depoliticized. You pay the money, you obey the rules, you pass the certification, you get it. On a practical level, you do see incidents where, I'll give you a good example. In New York, there was a restaurant, I think it was in New York, there was a restaurant called Jezebel, and the Orthodox Union essentially said, this name is inappropriate. If you don't change it, you don't get certification. There have been hotels which lost certification over which entertainment they decided to bring in, but for the most part, it's depoliticized. What happened with Ben and Jerry's has really brought this issue of what the proper balance between kashrut and other religious values should be to the fore. There was a group in Australia, the Kashrut Authority, which maintains a database of products, not necessarily products that they certify, but of products that they say these are kosher. And they announced that they were removing Ben & Jerry's because of its decision regarding the West Bank. And that led to, you know, really heated debates on Orthodox Facebook groups, WhatsApp groups. There's no real clear answer, but for the most part, we've managed to avoid overt and consistent politicization of kashrut. And I think, you know, politicizing it just opens up a Pandora's box that it's hard to close.
And it does seem a little unfair on somebody who keeps kosher, but might not agree with the settlement enterprise, who's no longer able to eat Ben and Jerry's because somebody in Australia decided that it was no longer kosher.
I really have trouble seeing that anybody is actually going to take this seriously who isn't already predisposed to start boycotting Ben & Jerry's. If someone wants to eat Ben & Jerry's, it has an OU. I don't think that's changing. I don't think that the Orthodox Union is going to suddenly say, you know what, we're going to risk our business ties with Unilever and with other corporations by taking a political stand, and anyone who wants to eat it is going to eat it. I had Ben & Jerry's over the weekend, and after a week of Ben and Jerry's news, all I could think was not, I want to talk about the West Bank, I want to talk about politics, was, I want to forget about politics, I just want some ice cream.
So, speaking of Ben and Jerry's and boycotts, there's one thing that I still can't quite get my head around. I'm not sure whether buying a pint of Chunky Monkey today means that I support BDS and I'm anti-Semitic, or whether it's an act of solidarity with the settlers. Any thoughts?
That's a great question, Simon. And I saw people struggling with this same issue last week, the morning after the big news broke about Ben and Jerry's. I went to one of their two scoop shops in Israel. It's located in the industrial area of Yavne, and spoke to people there. And, you know, the responses were a bit surprising. First of all, quite a few people I spoke with said they were proud left-wingers, but they were really, really angry about Ben and Jerry doing this, even though they were against the occupation, they believed in Palestinian rights, and they always voted for left-wing parties. But, you know, they said things like, this is not the way. I said, well, what is the way then? Not with violence. But is this violence? Yeah, they said this is economic violence.
Churned terrorism.
Yeah, okay. So, and then on the other hand, you know, some Israelis, their gut instinct, and we saw this with a minister of economy, Orna Barbivai, who posted a video of herself taking the Ben & Jerry's out of her freezer and throwing it in the trash can. And a lot of Israelis felt like doing that. But then the CEO of the local franchise said, please don't do that. I've got hundreds of workers here whose salaries I have to pay. If you all start boycotting Ben and Jerry's. Now, that's just going to hurt us. You're on our side, aren't you? You should be eating more ice cream, not less. So that was what people were like, who are we supporting here? The local guy? Yeah, we want to support him because he's been wronged, or a lot of people did think that. Mm-hmm. Or are we going to, who are we angry with? It? So I think at least for the next year and a half, when this is supposed to take effect, this boycott, Israelis will, if they think about it, they will say, you know, whether they're for or against the West Bank settlements, there's no reason to stop eating ice cream, except that there's probably better ice cream in Israel now than Ben and Jerry's.
Until we discover that Haagen-Dazs supports Hezbollah, right?
Well, they supported Kahana at one point, didn't they? I think they did.
Haagen-Dazs?
Yes. This was back in the 70s or 80s, but I think they did. It's owned by a Jewish family, or it was.
Well, that is a rabbit hole maybe for another episode. Yeah. All right, let's get back on track, shall we?
Yeah. Interestingly enough, there's a right-wing group in Israel, the Shu'at Adin Legal Center, which announced in what's obviously a legal stunt, but is quite interesting in terms of, you know, how people on the right are viewing this, that they are applying to distribute frozen dessert in the West Bank under the name Judea and Samaria's Ben and Jerry's. Their legal argument is essentially, bear with me, that by declining to sell in the West Bank, Unilever is basically giving up on its trademark in Israel, and therefore they should be allowed to swoop in and create a Judea and Samaria Ben and Jerry's. This obviously is not going to work, but I think it speaks to the response in certain sectors of the Israeli right.
Well, I think they're missing a trick and not calling it Binyamin and Yehuda, because you've got the B and the J right there. All right, let's get back on track. Judy, there's another area in which non-Haredi forces are making inroads, and you reported on ultra-Orthodox women running their own synagogues in Israel.
Orthodox women, not ultra-Orthodox.
Let's get back on track. Judy, there is another area in which non-Haredi forces are making inroads. Mm-hmm. You've reported on Orthodox women running their own synagogues. Mm-hmm. But I understand we're not allowed to call them rabbis.
Exactly. About a month or two ago, it was announced that for the first time, an Israeli woman, an Orthodox Israeli woman, would be running her own synagogue on her own, okay? This woman, who is known as Rabbanit Shira Mervis, lives in Efrat. She is about to complete, she may have completed already, a special Jewish studies program that is offered in these higher yeshivas for Orthodox women, which offer a very, very similar curriculum to rabbinical studies. Mm. Basically, they learn what somebody who wants to become an Orthodox rabbi here in Israel learns. But they are not called rabbis. There is a lot of resistance in the Orthodox movement in Israel, especially to using that term. So they're called rabbanit. What is a rabbanit? A rabbanit is a Hebrew word for rebbetzin. So it's a
rabbi's wife.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a bit misleading. Now, I spoke to Shira Mervis about this. She said, look, everyone who knows me knows that my husband's not a rabbi. He's in high tech. And they know that I'm not the woman who does like the old time Rebbetzin matchmaking and baking kugel. You know, they know that I'm a different type of rabbanit, and they know what the meaning of the word is here today. Now, but basically, she, for all intents and purposes, she is a rabbi. She is running her own shul. She is doing it on her own. There have been a few women before who were rabbanits who were involved in managing synagogues in Israel, but they were always next to a male rabbi. She's the first one who's doing it on her own. Now, what's really ironic about the whole situation is just a couple weeks after this Rabbanit Mervis, the news broke about her promotion to this new status, we learned that in the UK, a woman who was just about to receive her own ordination from the one yeshiva in New York that ordains women rabbis, she was fired from her position teaching at a well-known Jewish school for adults that is run by the Orthodox movement. And who oversees this school? Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, the chief rabbi. Same name as our rabbinate in Israel. He's her uncle.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Okay. The rabbinate in Israel didn't want to comment about that. But there was a huge outrage in the UK about this. And she was eventually, 2 weeks later, reinstated. So, yeah, these women, nobody wants, people are afraid to call them rabbis. There are a few in America who are now called rabbis, but they are slowly but surely breaking through the glass ceiling.
Baby steps.
Yes.
And it must be hard to make any progress on female rabbis when, as you mentioned, Sam, you have the Sephardi chief rabbi talking about female kashrut inspectors leading to sexual immorality. All right, listen, we promised that the weekend edition would be slightly more fun than the Occupation Iran spyware episodes that we record every Monday. So let's circle back to ice cream. Shall we? Judy, you told me that you've got the assignment of the summer.
Yeah.
Writing about some of the funky new flavors that have been appearing in Israeli gelaterias. If this is going in the direction of chocolate hummus, I'm not sure I want to hear about it. But what did you discover, Judy?
Okay. Onion flavored ice cream.
Okay, like that enough. It's, no.
I'm going to try it tomorrow. Okay. This is made at a boutique ice cream scoop shop in the town of Kalantsoa, the Arab town of Kalantsoa, okay, where they specialize in ice creams that are made incorporating fruits, which, okay, that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And vegetables, okay, hence the onions. So once I've been there, I will obviously report back. We are talking about ice creams that are made with za'atar has become a big thing. What is that? Hyssop in English, right? Hyssop. It's a very popular spice used, but not in sweet things. We are talking about, here's an Israeli twist on cappuccino flavored ice cream. It's Arabic coffee with cardamom, hail.
Ooh,
you know.
That sounds okay.
Yes, that's at Buzo. You know, this is a really unique little ice cream chain that was formed by a kibbutznik up north and an Arab citizen from a nearby town of Tarshicha. And they're very, very popular, and they make fabulous ice cream with all local products, mostly from the Galilee where they come from. What else? Knafa. You know the Arabic dessert knafa?
Of course.
Very, very, very popular.
Delicious.
So there's one of the oldest ice cream chains, by the way, in Israel, is called Shvaram Ice Cream, which is from the Arab city of Shvaram. Mm. And they've been around for more than 70 years. But until about 2-3 years ago, they only had 3 flavors there. Now, one of the sons or grandsons has come into the business, and he is into experimenting. So they have new ice creams that are based on famous Middle Eastern desserts, and one of them is their knafa-flavored ice cream, which is really, really popular. And, of course, you will find, like, you know, what could be more Israeli than halva, tchina, we've got all that. I have not yet heard of hummus ice cream. Olive ice cream. Olive, Kalamata olive ice cream. I'm going to try that next week. But so hummus ice cream, no, I haven't. There's a red line.
And I think falafel is on the other side of that red line. Anything there take your fancy, Sam?
Not particularly. I'll say possibly the olive, but the mention of the possibility of hummus ice cream makes me think of what's been happening with hummus in America recently, where they're making strawberry hummus and cookie dough hummus. And all I can think of is this might be the only issue that can unite all the different peoples and religions of the Middle East in saying, no, this is an abomination before man and God. Please stop.
Leave our hummus alone.
Yes.
All right. Guys, on that note, we're going to wrap things up for this week. Judy, Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, too, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again on Monday with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, Shabbat Shalom from Tel Aviv.